This is Thoughts on the Table by DisgracesOnTheMenu.com.
Hello and welcome to Thoughts on the Table, the audio blog on food and food culture. Paolo here again for another episode, and my guest today is cookbook author and food writer Domenica Marchetti. Hi, Domenica.
Hi, Paolo.
Did I pronounce your name correctly?
Oh, yes, you did. Beautifully.
Though probably I pronounced it with a Northern Italian accent when maybe it shouldn't be Northern Italian accent. In North Italian, we pronounce our E really open, Marchetti, whereas in the center and south,
it's probably Marchetti. Like,
yeah. Yes, interesting. So a couple of words on Domenica. I've been knowing Domenica for a very long time. I've been following her and I knew some of her books. And in 2012, a long time ago now, I gave her the Canola Award for preserving Italian food, which obviously she deserves very much. And to be honest, ever since I started this podcast, I always wanted to get her on the show, but I never really did until a common friend of ours, Frank Fariello, encouraged me to do so. So here I am talking with Domenica. I am very happy.
Well, it's a delightful to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for saying that. So, Domenica, obviously this is an interview. We're going to be talking about you. Hopefully you're okay with that.
Yeah, sure.
And as always with my guests, when they have obvious Italian origins, I'll ask you to talk a little bit about you and your family, of course. How did you get to the United States?
I was born here. I was born in Yonkers, New York, in fact, but my parents are Italian. Actually, my mother was born and raised in Italy, in Abruzzo, in Chieti, in the city of Chieti. And my father was born and raised in New England, in Rhode Island, but both of his parents came over from Italy. And his mother was from Isernia, which is in Molise, and his father was from a little town called Fondi in Lazio.
I see. So you're, I guess, second generation from your dad and first generation from your mom.
100%, though, I like to say. I'm 100% Italian.
Yeah, no, because you didn't stop there. Of course, your ties to Italy extended past your parents. You've been going back to Italy frequently as a child, and you continue all throughout your life, correct?
Yes, that's right. My mother's family stayed in Italy. She had three sisters, actually, who never married. And so, yeah, they shared an apartment in Rome for many years. And we had a beach house on the Adriatic coast of Abruzzo in Silvi Marina. So I used to spend my summers a little bit in Rome and then at the beach in Silvi Marina. And I have so many wonderful memories of those years. I had such a fortunate childhood. I had many friends from those days and I still keep in touch. So yeah, that was a big part of my growing up.
It sounds fantastic. I can almost picture it. It's a common memory I share with a beach house. Actually, for me, it was Tuscany, though.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. Well, we didn't own it. We were going there on vacation, rented for a few weeks, for the entire month, which is something that Italians tend to do.
It's really wonderful. That's right. And we would meet our same friends every summer. They would come. We had a lot of friends from Naples and some friends from Silvi Marina and other places. And even we had our comitiva and we would all meet in Silvi and, you know, spend days on the beach and nights going out and eating, you know, patatine and arrosticini and dancing. And, you know, it was just really the quintessential Italian summer.
Fantastic. And you said it also when you were in the United States, when you went back home, your mom taught you how to cook, you and your sister.
Yes, my mom was a wonderful cook. She doesn't cook so much anymore. She's quite elderly. But she was kind of a self-taught cook because she had a cook in her house when she was growing up. But she enjoyed it. And when she came over to the United States, she came over by boat in her early 20s. And she just was in love with America. And this was after World War II. And I think a lot of Italians were in love with the United States and wanted to see America. And she came over and decided to stay. But she really started cooking when she met my dad in New York and when they got married. So she was kind of self-taught, but she was really a wonderful, creative cook. And she did. She taught me how to make fresh pasta and ravioli and cappelletti, you know, the little tortellini like in brodo, yeah. And all of those wonderful traditional dishes that I still love to make.
Really admirable, yeah, because she moved there in her 20s, so she was really young.
And yeah.
As it often happens, this was the case for my mother too, though she didn't move, but she got married that young, and she didn't know how to cook, because when you're the filia, the daughter, mm-hmm. you your mom is cooking for you, and really, it's like automatic. You have to learn before you get married, I guess.
Right.
But sometimes you don't. So for my mom too, it was cookbooks and sometimes asking my grandma for some advice. But she too had to learn at that point.
Yes, my mom has a big Ada Boni, you know, Il Talismano della Felicità, and she used that a lot. And yeah. She recently gave that book to me, and I absolutely love it. It's, for me, going back is sort of moving forward. I just love looking at those old recipes and mm-hmm. being inspired by them.
Yes, it's also, there's the silver spoon, Il Cucchiaio d'Argento.
Yes.
Another one that was always in my family. Yeah.
Yes.
Also, you said in the emails we exchanged that you raised two kids and you also taught them how to cook. So this is also another thing that Italian families tend to do and, you know, preserve.
Yeah, well, I've tried anyway. My son, he's in college now. He's a freshman in college. Mm-hmm. And he, you know, cooking is not really his passion. His favorite thing to make, believe it or not, is a grilled peanut butter, bacon, and banana sandwich.
Okay.
So he's kind of American that way. My daughter loves to cook and bake. Interestingly, though, she's not really into Italian cooking, maybe because I do so much of that. What she really loves to do is Asian cuisine. She has made homemade pho, you know, the Vietnamese beef noodle soup. She's made some wonderful fresh homemade sushi dinners. She loves to cook Chinese and Thai.
Fantastic.
So it's very interesting. But what's also interesting is that when I was a teenager, I also loved to cook Chinese and Asian food. You know, we had some Chinese cookbooks from the 70s, and I would use those. And so I think any kind of cuisine a child likes to cook, you know, anything that encourages them to be in the kitchen is wonderful. So I feel like both my kids know their way around the kitchen, and they will come back to Italian cuisine at some point. It's inevitable because it's the best food in the world.
You're not biased.
No, not really.
Okay, so, but I want to now a little bit talk about how you became a food writer and a cookbook author. You didn't start that way. You started as a journalist. Is that right?
That's right. I did start as a journalist. Originally, when I was in college, I thought about writing as a career. Really, what I was interested in was becoming a foreign correspondent, and I mm-hmm. wanted to go to Rome. I actually ended up doing a maybe 4-month unpaid internship with the Associated Press in Rome.
I see.
And my hope was to go back, but all of a sudden, you know, all these news organizations started losing money and closing mm-hmm. their Rome bureaus, and I ended up, of all places, in Detroit, Michigan, so pretty far from Rome. Although I actually loved it. I spent 7 years in Detroit, and that's where I met my husband, and we ended up in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. in the 1990s, and I worked as a reporter and a writer for a newspaper called the Chronicle of Philanthropy, so I was covering mm-hmm. the nonprofit world. But then I had my son and then my daughter. They're less than 2 years apart, so pretty mm-hmm. close together, and it was very difficult having a full-time job and taking care of them, and mm-hmm. so I wanted more flexibility in my schedule, so I decided to start freelancing. And I was always interested in food writing, and I had done some health and nutrition writing mm-hmm. and a little bit of food writing, but I was amassing cookbooks and constantly looking through my cookbooks. You know, I would get home from work and I would start reading my cookbooks, and I loved them so much. And I just kind of decided to reinvent myself a little bit as a food writer. And I started freelancing and sending out queries using the newspaper contacts that I had. And eventually that led to, I think I went to a food writers conference, very small, intimate food writing conference, where I met a cookbook editor for my first publisher, Chronicle Books. And I sent a proposal out for a little book on Italian soups and stews, and my editor loved it. And that's actually how I got into cookbook writing. It was kind of through journalism.
It shows, by the way, because again, your approach is very journalistic in the sense that the amount of research that you put in, and it's all fact-based.
Yeah, I find that I use my journalism skills all the time. You know, whenever I travel to Italy, I'm always in search of lost recipes or recipes that I didn't know of before. And there are so many. That's the incredible thing about Italian food and cooking, is that no matter how many times I go there, every time I go, I discover something new. And there are so many, wonderful, talented food artisans in Italy, and I just love shining a light on them and their work. So that's what my books are all about.
Right. The potential is enormous. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And we get new new tradition being formed as well. I wanted to ask you, in fact, about tradition and innovation. I recently had a podcast with Francesca Mastrovito, who is a recommender, is a great writer, and she wrote a university thesis on this topic. And I wanted your take on this. So how much to you are traditions important when you're trying to innovate, and whether the two concepts are in contradiction to each other or they're not?
This is such a great question, and I'm not familiar with her work, so I'm definitely going to look her up, because this is a subject I think about so often. Because as somebody who travels to Italy often, but who lives in Virginia, basically suburban Washington, D.C., you know, the ingredients I have access to are in some ways completely different. You know, we get a lot of good imported Italian ingredients, but there are some things that we can't get here, so I have to improvise. And none of us cooks in a vacuum, right? So cuisine is always evolving. And if you look at like the history of Sicilian cuisine, there's the Spanish, you know, the Moorish influence, the Arab influence, the French influence, the Swiss bakers who went down there. I mean, there's just so many influences that contributed to the incredible cuisine that is Sicilian food. So in a sense, you know, tradition has, it's always been evolving. I try to start from the point of tradition, you know, like if I'm making pesto. I interviewed, I don't know if you're familiar with Roberto Panizza, who is kind of the ambassador of pesto in Genoa.
Actually, I don't know him.
Oh, yeah, he's a wonderful person. His family has owned food shops in Genoa for several generations, and he has a restaurant called Il Genovese. But one of his, some years ago, I think back in 2007, he started a pesto competition, an international pesto competition, because he was seeing all these bastardizations of pesto, and he wanted to bring it back to the original. So, you know, he says people use the word pesto first in so many contexts now, but really, there is only one pesto. Now, even he acknowledges that the original pesto from the, what was it, 15th, 16th, or 17th century is different from 20th or 21st century pesto. But so everything is always evolving. But there is a point of, you know, of tradition, which I think is important for cooks to acknowledge or to begin with. Right now, I'm seeing a lot of chefs making, quote, chitarra noodles. And they put them together with all sorts of non-traditional sauces. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't work. Well, you know, who knows what the chitarra is? I mean, if you're an Abruzzese, you probably have a chitarra in your kitchen. It's one of those wooden instruments strung with metal wires. And it was actually, quote, an innovative way for women to cut pasta in the 19th and early 20th centuries before, you know, before the Atlas pasta machine came around. But So when you talk about chitarra noodles in a restaurant, are you cutting them on a chitarra? Are you using a chitarra cutter on a hand crank machine? Or are you just cutting noodles and calling them chitarra because it's, you know, it's the trend right now?
Yeah.
So there are all these things to consider. It's such a big question. I think tradition is important because I don't want to lose those wonderful traditional recipes, like traditional pesto, like risotto alla milanese, you know, like real cannoli, as they're made in Sicily. And I think with the internet explosion and the explosion of blogs, and you can look up global cuisine, you know, here I am in my home in Virginia, I can find out how to, you know, make real homemade ramen noodles, or like I was saying, my daughter can make homemade pho broth. So, you know, I think that the instinct is to just get creative and do everything, but I'd like to think that we can also not forget tradition, because it's important where these recipes come from.
Well, I always say, you know, there's a reason why they're traditional. They happen to be very successful combinations. And so that's why I think it's important to start from there and always know that. Just like when you study art, you need to know the history of art before you can actually think about maybe becoming an artist.
That's a great point. Yeah, no, I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, some argue maybe if you don't have any contamination, you can be pure. But I would argue back that it's impossible not to have any contamination. So you're always going to have some influences. The more you know about the traditional ones and the important one in history, I think the better chance you'll have to have, you know, your all your elements to actually start composing something of your own.
That's very nice. That's a very eloquent way of putting it. Yeah.
I also think that traditions kind of inform our palate in a way. You get attuned to that particular, you know, range of flavors, and you now appreciate that because some flavors are acquired, like the flavor of blue cheese or the flavor of bitter greens.
Yes, which I adore. Yes.
Yeah. Not everybody, you know, it's not a thing that you can just taste and like immediately. But if you grow up in such an environment where those are a part of the dish, then they grow on you. And now you form that palate. Another thing about Italian palate that I always talk about is the fact that there is such thing as a delicate flavor and appreciation for a delicate flavor. Like the flavor of mozzarella, which arguably is very faint. You know, it's a delicate flavor, absolutely.
Yes.
It's milky, but such a fantastic one.
I agree. That's a really good point, because really good mozzarella has that, you know, the certain tang about it and that milkiness. It's rich. It's a little acidic. It's also about the texture, you know, the creaminess, that chewiness. And now I'm really craving mozzarella. And I'm snowed in, so I can't go to the store. But yeah, I think those delicate qualities definitely do exist. Or say saffron, you know, that's in Abruzzo, they grow wonderful saffron that I, you know, maybe I'm biased because that's where I'm from, but the Navelli Plain has the perfect microclimate for growing the crocuses from which the saffron comes. Mm-hmm. And you only need a pinch of it, but it's got that earthy aroma and flavor. It's a little bit curry, a little bit warm and muddy, and there's nothing like it. And then, yeah, so I think these delicate flavors are something that Italians are very attuned to.
Mm-hmm. I also think there's something to say about the technique as well that you use to cook these ingredients, which is something you learn this time from seeing another cook, you know, perform, put together a dish. And that's how you make your soup, you know, starting from a sofrito, for instance. Certain types of soups are made starting with a dry base that gets roasted first, and then the liquid gets added. Or for a lot of Italian tomato sauces, again, there is a start to it, maybe with onion or garlic or the combination. You need to have your basic elements. Well, the French cuisine is the apotheosis of this, where obviously it's all about the technique as well as the ingredients.
Yeah, French food is so much about technique. But I think that people can be deceived when they hear that Italian cuisine is, quote, simple. It can be simple, but it's not necessarily easy. You do have to know a few basics. You know, when you're putting together an Italian soup, you start with those three, the holy trinity of Italian ingredients, the minced carrot, onion, and celery. Maybe you add in some garlic or parsley or chopped rosemary. Mm-hmm. You kind of develop your flavors in the pan with olive oil. And then you start adding, you know, if you're making a minestrone, maybe you'll add a little cut up potato or a little green bean or something.
And you roast them.
Right. And you let those flavors develop. And then you have to decide whether it's going to be minestra in bianco or in rosso if you're going to add tomato sauce, and then your broth, and everything cooks nice and slowly until all the flavors develop and the vegetables are nice and soft. We don't really, you know, everybody's so about the crunchy vegetables, but sometimes vegetables really need to be cooked, you know. And I think
it's interesting.
That's the difference between Italians and Americans. I think these techniques are important. And I actually taught a class on making homemade Italian soups for a website called craftsy.com. And it's an online, it's kind of like an online school for all sorts of crafts and cooking. And so it's like a video school. And you know, people can just go to craftsy.com and sign up for the class and learn how to make an Italian brodo di carne, how to make minestrone, pasta e fagioli, ribollito, all these wonderful Italian traditional soups that are so good and we all love.
Awesome, fantastic. You also have books on pasta, the glorious pastas of Italy is called.
Yeah, that was a fun one to write. We ate a lot of fresh pasta that year. People are so intimidated by making fresh pasta, but the truth is, once you know, it's like anything, the more you practice, the better you get at it. And, you know, I got to the point where I could start making pasta at 5 in the afternoon and put dinner on the table by 7. It's really, it's just one of those wonderful pursuits. And there's nothing like a dish of fresh pasta for dinner. So,
absolutely.
Especially on a weeknight, you know, it feels a little luxurious, but it's quite simple once you get the hang of the technique.
That's right. And also, I like your next book that talks about the vegetables of Italy. Again, because vegetables are so unknown, there's always everything about the protein.
Yes,
is that right?
Right, and I think people associate Italian cooking with pasta, with pizza, with cheese, with, you know, those iconic sweets like cannoli or whatever, but they don't necessarily think about vegetables. But when you think about Italy itself, it's a Mediterranean country with so many microclimates, and so many vegetables grow beautifully in Italy, and the Italians really put them to wonderful use in so many ways, soups, in pasta sauces, just as standalone dishes. Just the variety of chicories. You were talking about bitter foods earlier. The varieties of chicories in the Veneto is astounding. These things grow so well. So, you know, Italians are not wasteful. They are resourceful cooks. And so they have ways to turn all of these things into wonderful foods.
That's right. Absolutely. Absolutely. I love vegetables. My wife is a vegetarian and I sort of became I consider myself half vegetarian. I eat fish, but I don't eat meat anymore. And again, I don't miss it because again, there's so much, even meatiness, I would call it, in some vegetables, like tomatoes. Tomatoes are fantastic.
True. Tomatoes, eggplant, mushrooms, very meaty vegetables.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. Changing to your next book instead. We talk about sweets, biscotti.
Yes.
So can you describe what he talks about and what kind of biscotti are you talking about in the book?
Yeah, it was a fun little book to write. My publisher approached me asking me if I wanted to write a book on Italian biscotti. And by that, they really meant the cantucci, the twice-baked, you know, almond cookies from Tuscany.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I was a little bit hesitant because I thought, well, you know, what can you do? It's one recipe, right? It's sugar, flour, eggs, and almonds. But this is where Italian and American cooking merges. And so you have the Italian tradition and then the American extrapolation. So what I did is I started adding things like a little bit of grated chocolate in one recipe or orange peel, or I used pistachios. You know, I did chocolate and ginger biscotti for Christmas and dried cranberries. And so I ended up with a very fun little book of about 50 recipes. And And it was really delightful to write. And I also have a little chapter on what I call Beyond Biscotti, which is basically other of my favorite types of Italian cookies, like ricciarelli and amaretti di pistacchio and some hazelnut butter cookies and, you know, a couple of other kinds. So in Italy, the twice-baked cookies are called cantucci. In the United States and probably everywhere else in the world, they're called biscotti. So it's a little bit confusing, but, you know, that's how things, you know, when things go around the world, changes happen, right?
Well, in this case, I think North America got it right, because these are biscotti, which means cooked twice.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it is a proper name. Instead, in Italy, it's always been the name for cookies in general, even though they could be frullini, which are essentially shortbread, that are not cooked twice. They're just crunchy on their own, and they come out of the oven that way.
Right.
And you have a new one coming. Is that right?
I do. I have a new book that is will be released on June 14th. It's called Preserving Italy, and it's all about all of the wonderful ways Italians preserve food. So I'm talking about sotto olio, sotto aceto, so foods preserved in oil, foods preserved in vinegar, marmellate, confetture, you know, marmalades, jams, fruit pastes, condimenti, mostarda. Then I have a little bit of fresh cheeses in there, a little bit of simple salumi and sausages, sciroppi, liquori. I have to say, the more I worked on this book, the more I realized that you can't really understand and master Italian cuisine without incorporating these preserving traditions, because this is a cuisine that was based on food from the earth, cucina povera, not wasting anything.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the giardiniera, the sottaceti, the sottolio, this is all an important part of the Italian palate and the Italian table. There's always some form of preserved food at the table in
Italy. You said not wasting anything. In this case, it's because things will go bad, you know, it will spoil if you don't preserve them using some techniques, especially in the days where fridges were not common. You would sometimes get a block of ice, and that was, you know, the best that you could do. Obviously, canning became a necessity to kind of have food for winter, you know. And
exactly, yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write this book is because with modern cooking and the fact that, you know, in general, societies are much more affluent, you don't really need to preserve anymore. I mean, you can go to the come si chiama, the supermercato, you know, the co-op in Italy, and you will find an aisle full of jars of, you know, sottaceti and sottoli, and you don't really have to do it yourself anymore. So one of my concerns was losing these preserving traditions. So when I, you know, the title Preserving Italy is no accident. I mean, I really wanted I wanted to collect these recipes so that they wouldn't be lost. When I did my research, I was so happy to find out that there are so many wonderful food artisans who are still working on preserving these traditions. You know, there are people who are involved with the slow food movement in Italy, and, you know, the slow food presidia. And so in the book, I have profiles of several food artisans because I wanted to showcase the work that they're doing to save these traditions. It's so important. So in that respect, I think this maybe is my most satisfying book to write.
I will definitely look forward to getting my hands on it as soon as it comes out. It sounds amazing. I don't know much about preserving. Like you said, I grew up with the co-op around the corner, the supermarket. there's also some considerations about preserving. I think my mom was concerned that it could develop, you know, some toxins from not doing it properly. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's a big concern with preserving, especially. And I actually still see recipes that call for, you know, basically what the technique is, salting the vegetable, drying it out, pickling it in a vinegar brine, drying it out again, and then putting it under oil. But I still see some recipes that call for tucking in, say, a raw piece of garlic. You know, that's not good because botulism, which, you know, can grow, does not need air to grow. It's perfectly at home and under oil. So you really have to make careful considerations. But if you follow directions. Yeah. There's definitely so much. I can tell you that we had a blizzard here in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. and I didn't have to go out and buy any vegetables because I have, you know, a big jar of jardiniere. I have pickled peppers. I have, you know, tomatoes under oil, and I have passata that I made and canned. And so I have a whole pantry full of vegetables that I can rely on until, you know, my dear husband and daughter dig me out and I can go to the store again.
It sounds really amazing. Domenica, thank you so much. We are out of time for this episode. We could definitely connect again later on and do one more, for sure, when the book comes out. How about that?
Yes, absolutely. This has been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I truly enjoyed it.
Awesome. Fantastic, Domenica. The pleasure was all mine, as we say in Italy, selfishly.
Thank you, Paolo.
Talk soon. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.